Welcome to the Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swanger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about cybersecurity and technology news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Speaking of, the other day, my boss asked me what steps I would be taking in the event of a fire drill. Apparently, the answer he was looking for was not big ones.
First article is on fire drills and phishing tests. And this is something we pulled from Google's blog. And this is written by Matt Litton. And this is a blog post that he wrote, which is comparing phishing training to the evolution of fire drills and, you know, how those were created to prepare for potential fires. And it starts off with a brief history of the concept of fire drills. So in the late 19th, early 20th century, there were some rather horrible fires. I'm trying to think of the one. I should have looked this up before. But there's a really bad one in Georgia at a textile factory.
Yeah, I know exactly the one you're talking about, where they lock the doors to keep them inside. And it was all women and children in there doing the weaving or whatever.
Right.
I don't remember what it was called either, but I know what you're talking about.
But based on, you know, these huge fires that killed a whole bunch of people, they're like, hey, we need to do something about this. And one of the concepts they came up with was the idea of fire evacuation tests. And this is going to seem weird because we're used to the way fire drills are run today. But apparently, the early tests were rating individual performance. You know, basically, George Costanza, how skilled are you at getting out of a building that's on fire?
I'm loving my mental image of this, of like people like elbowing and tripping other people to get out because they're like, no, I must win.
Yep. Well, the first thing that popped into my mind was that one episode of Seinfeld where George Costanza like knocks over an old lady in a walker, I think, because he thinks there's an actual fire to get out of the building. So they were testing people based on how fast they got out. And these were surprise tests. And they didn't tell them that it was a drill. People thought these were actual fires and then they were need to get out of the building.
I would love to have seen that. Like, I'm just imagining like people like fleeing each other and like you're talking about like knocking people over and being like, get out of my way.
Yeah. So obviously this resulted in more injuries than an improved survival rate for actual fires. And also it turns out that they were basically worthless. They did not improve survival rates at all when they were actual fires. But what did bring down survival rate or bring down survival rates, increase survival rates, were improvements in fire protection stuff. So wider doors, push bar exits, fire breaks in construction, lighted exit signs, things of that nature. And survival rates for fires have steadily improved since this time also.
I have a question for you. A lot of these things like wider doors, push bars at exit, lighted exit signs, those are things that the government put in place. I know how you feel about the government in general. Is this, in your opinion, an appropriate use of government? I'm sorry for putting you on the spot. You can tell me to fuck off and...
Well, I don't think there's ever an appropriate use of government. I mean, ancillarily, the fact that the government did this and it improved survival rates, I think, is just coincidental.
I'm trying to imagine a world where these aren't government regulations. I can just see people like interviewing for jobs and being like, what are your fire... You know, like what is the place that we work at like?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that my perspective on this is this kind of goes back to the stuff we've talked about before about regulation versus law enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, if more building owners or factory owners or whatever were held to account for creating unsafe environments where people got killed, then it would have incentivized them to come up with these kind of concepts on their own in order to improve the survivability of the people in their factory versus mandating it from the government.
So you wouldn't have the government enforce it. You would have it enforced through people suing the factory owner and driving them out of business.
Not necessarily suing the factory owner, but if you're a building owner and you bar the door so people cannot get out in the case of fire.
Oh, you should be charged for murder.
You should be hung. Right?
Gotcha. Yeah.
So you do public hanging for this guy, and maybe the next guy will not chain the doors to his building and things of that nature. And you could also have, I'm not saying lawsuits are can't be on top of that wrongful death, et cetera, because if you're, so, you know, if one member of the family gets killed in there, that's all the lost revenue from that family that they're not going to get from that breadwinner anymore. So they should be able to sue him for lost wages or lost income because that guy was negligent and caused that guy's death. You know, stuff like that could incentivize people to come up with these same concepts or maybe even better ones. I don't know.
Yeah.
On top of that.
I'm so unused to the law actually applying to businesses and business owners that it was totally foreign to me. I didn't even think about it.
Well, we'll get into that a little bit in the next article too. Actually, so yeah, and obviously because we're all used to the today's fire drills where they're announced and everything, and we have evacuation signs posted and everything, that's a state where fire drills have evolved to today. And apparently there are actually regulations, FedRAMP, that are requiring fishing drills like fire drills are required, like fire drills have been required in the past. And this is the standard thing where a security team creates a phishing email and they track how many emails go out, what's the impact of the email, how many emails are opened, you know, and then the mandatory training if you actually click on the link or put in your credentials or whatever from that. And
sometimes
that way,
get fired. I've heard of companies that actually fire people that click on too many phishing links.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's actually kind of weird because for a while I had heard places saying that, oh no, you know, of course we wouldn't do that. And then I've heard recently from people who have worked at companies that did in fact fire people for that.
How many is too many? What's the tipping point there?
I don't know that answer.
I mean, it sounds far-fetched, but if you consider that, you know, the main accountant that you have that manages your Swift account at a financial institution continually falls for phishing emails every time, maybe, you know, that person is not the right one to be in that job because that's a high risk role. Should their account get compromised, that you have a huge financial loss from that. It all depends on, you know, the volume and context. It sounds more far-fetched than anything I've seen anyway.
Now, like I said, I'd never seen or heard of this before. Pretty much every place I'd ever worked has been like, you just get training. There's no real consequences for failure.
Right. And I'm just wondering how much that gets back to the managers. I haven't been someplace that wherever I was a manager where I got phishing dashboards or whatever for what my employees' results were during the phishing tests, where that would influence how they rate the employee or something like that as well. I don't know. But these phishing tests are equating or kind of the equivalents of the old fire drills where you're supposed to recognize that there's something dangerous going on and individually react in the appropriate way. Failure is an individual failure, just like the old fire test versus a systemic problem. And I think, you know, and this is obviously what guy who wrote this blog article is saying, but I don't think that's exactly right, because failure to identify a fish and respond to it isn't an individual failure. It's not a systemic problem. You know, the systemic problem might be the org's inability to stop or prevent that individual failure from leading to a bigger problem. But I would not say that a phishing failure should not be considered an individual failure, the same way that failure to properly evacuate in a fire was an individual failure. But I think there's some notable differences between this example of how phishing drills relate back to fire drills, because phishing emails in general are not deadly, for one, and not responding to a fire evacuation order would only kill me. It would not cause the entire building to catch fire and burn down, which could happen in, not literally, obviously, but in the case of a phishing email where you click on that, someone clicks on a phishing email and it ends up in a compromise of the entire enterprise. And then he goes on to list what he calls harmful side effects of modern day phishing tests. The first one being, there's no evidence that test results result in fewer incidents of successful phishing campaigns. And he quotes in here a study that had 14,000 participants that had repeat clickers that will consistently fail the test despite recent interventions.
Yeah. And I saw a talk back in at RVA Sec, I think, gosh, back in like 2017 or something, that had very similar results. I was a security analyst working at a hospital, and he was talking about how he ran the phishing tests and he just had folks who clicked on literally everything, no matter what it was.
I don't have any insight into that. just weird.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could delete an email, I'd do it. I don't read it.
Yeah.
And one of the other list of harmful effects is the next one is apparently FedRAMP guidance requires the bypass of systematic controls to increase the likelihood or artificially increase the likelihood that a phishing link is going to be clicked.
Yeah, this is basically kind of like with a penetration test where you start inside the network. So they're dodging your proof point or your whatever gateway you have for phishing.
I'm not entirely opposed to the idea of them starting inside the network. What I am opposed to, though, is them starting inside the network with their tricked out laptop. You know, yeah, if they start inside
the fancy stuff
with all their downloaded tools and everything already on the box, it's a Linux, Kali Linux box or whatever. You know, if they're in your network, they're not going to have that. You give them a generic box off the shelf.
I'm going to download your tools.
And say, here, you have a login. That's all you get. You have to get your tools. You have to do all that. Because one of the other things you're checking for, you know, as part of incident response is those indicators, right? That someone's downloading tools, et cetera. And if you take that away, then that's something else that another advantage that they have, which is unrealistic from a pen test red team kind of perspective.
Yeah. Yep. I think I get why they do it. The common complaint is that it takes so long to find a hole. Like, are you hiring the team to, you know, spend 2 to 4 weeks like finding a way in like a dedicated attacker might? But then they tend to treat the results like they're gospel. Mm-hmm. We're ignoring multiple levels of something that might have stopped a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, it probably would not have stopped a dedicated APT who really wanted to get into your specific environment. But those outside layers don't have to stop that most of the time. They have to stop. It's like the bear. You don't have to be the fastest guy. You just have to be faster than the slowest guy. I just heard the other day about listening to a webinar about ransomware operators. It's funny because we talk so much about APTs and threat intel, and the vast majority of them are apparently just opportunistic. They will hit whoever they can reach. They don't target specific. They don't actually target specific verticals or industries.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to make money.
Right. Yeah. I mean, typically government are the only ones that are targeted, or government adjacent businesses are the ones that targeted that they're, you have attackers actively targeting them specifically versus targeting any bank or any insurance company or just anybody who could be ransomware.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I understand you have to treat it differently if you're in certain industries. 100% agree on that. I think the majority of us, if we're not in one of those special industries, we should be focusing on different things.
Yeah, we should be focused on outrunning our friend and not the bear. Or outrunning our competitors and not the bear.
Your competitors, which you should be focused on doing anyway, so.
Yeah, just another aspect, right? Yeah, exactly. It's just another level of competition. Another harm that he listed is response teams have to respond to test notifications. Employees get upset and think the security team is tricking them, which degrades trust in the security team. And then the last harm we list is large enterprises may have multiple independent phishing products. So you have people getting phish test multiple times from multiple different groups. And I think harm in this entire, virtually the entire list is really a bit of an exaggeration, if you want to call it harm.
You know,
the fact that phishing training doesn't work is not directly harmful to the organization.
It's just a waste of money.
Yeah. Well, and bypassing control, that's just stupid, not harmful. You know, and if your incident response team is responding to phishing training, you bought a bad phishing tool.
Yeah, that one bugged me a lot. Like, especially if you buy, a lot of times the companies that offer the reporting button will also offer the phishing training. And if you should be able to programmatically handle that. But and sometimes there's ways around that. Like maybe they forward it. Your user doesn't know the correct way to do it. They forward it to a cybersecurity address or something like that. But the vast, like 98% of them should be handled automatically.
Yep, easily.
God, can you imagine having like 10,000 employees and then telling them like, when you get a phishing email, report it, and then sending out a fake phishing email and having them all report it?
Yeah, that'd be horrible.
Like 20% of people report it, so you have 1,000 emails pouring into that box.
Well, and then you've got legitimate phishes that are in there somewhere.
Oh, they're hidden in there.
Right?
Yep.
That would just be a nightmare. Especially if all those employees are also expecting an answer back. Get some kind of affirmation that they did the right thing or whatever. Okay, and moving on. The loss of trust, I would not categorize that as a loss of trust. Employees are not going to not trust the security organization because they tried to do this phishing training. They may dislike them. But I don't think it's actually going to cause any loss of trust of the security team. I've never seen that or heard that before.
Yeah, maybe before, like when this was first coming out. But like, I feel like at this point in time, pretty much everybody understands phishing training and it's just something that you have to do.
Yeah, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that would be a problem.
Yeah.
But not today. The other thing he mentioned about large orgs having multiple phishing training programs, that's an organizational failure. That is not anything against the training itself. I would say if you want to call out actual harm for the phishing training, it would be the waste of money and resources that you spend on the training tool and the people to support it that does not actually produce any risks or reduce any risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's actual harm there. Now, because of, you know, what he's calling about the harms and the lack of relevance here and the very realization that you cannot stop 100% of phishing emails from being clicked. Yeah. You just can't get to 100%. The security industry should move towards de-emphasizing surprise and tricks and move this more towards a phishing fire drill kind of scenario, where you educate your users about how to spot phishing emails, inform them on how to report, allow the employees to practice reporting the phishing emails, and collect metrics on that, such as, you know, how many people completed the training, how many people got emails, how many opened it, how many forwarded, how long did it take between the time they received it and the time they reported it, things of that nature. And I think this is actually a pretty good concept. With typical phishing training that's sent out, most users don't report. And they may not know to report, or they just delete the email. And you don't know how many people recognize it as a phish in actuality versus simply those that clicked on the link.
Yeah, and I think this is a large part of the employee base. I've seen phishing trainings where they report. That's one of the metrics they show is how many people reported it. But usually, I mean, if I'm thinking of most companies, like they typically do like an anti-phishing / security training once a year, and then they have to do these phishing tests like quarterly or annually or once a month or once a day. I don't know.
Right.
And I think it'd be interesting to see like the percentage of people who report the phishing email like over time is going down or going up based on when they had that training. But I guess the other part of it is does the training, like, this is a common problem with training. You give somebody training at a point in time, but then you have to reinforce it. It's not enough to just show them a picture and say, oh, report email. You should report it. How do I report it? Where do I report it? What does that look like in my Outlook or, you know, Google or whatever?
Right. And you're expecting them to remember that 9 months later.
Yeah.
Also, and I'm kind of thinking that, you know, it may be less important that employees can recognize a phishing email and than it is for them to know how to report it, since you're always going to have gaps there. And as long as someone's able to spot the email and report it, then at least you have some kind of reporting that you can respond to.
Gotcha. Yeah, it makes sense. So, and it's funny because this is the opposite of the common statement about how defenders have to be perfect all the time and the attackers only have to be right once and they can be wrong all the time breaking in. But that's not true. Attackers may not have to be perfect, but there are plenty of spots along the compromise chain where they can be caught. Like in this case, when they send out a phishing email, they're probably not going to target one user. They're going to target, if it's a ransomware group that's being opportunistic, they may target hundreds of users. And you just need one user reporting it, and then you can start tracking it down based on IP address and link and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, it's almost the deal where you only have to be right once.
Yeah.
Where you only have to have one user report.
Yeah, because if you don't detect them on that initial phish, you've got a chance to detect them when they download the malware or when they, you know, open up their CNC channel back. You don't detect them then, you've got a chance to download, you've got a chance to catch them when they're moving laterally. Of course, the big issue there is that most of your protections are front-loaded against guarding against that initial stage. And a lot of times when attackers get into the network, it's just a delicious, open, tasty middle.
I would say even with this concept, though, that you may want to do advanced training for key individuals, you know, VIPs, people in accounting, maybe HR, you know, someone that can have that is susceptible to CEO fraud, things like that.
Yeah, if you've got one person who does all of your payments, they need to be very well trained.
Yeah, and you may even want to consider additional restrictions on those types of individuals too, where, you know, they cannot get out to the internet or something like that. Something, I mean, that thing may seem a bit heinous, but, you know, if you have somebody that could bankrupt your company by making a mistake, maybe you can say, okay, well, you're not going to be allowed out to the internet, I'm sorry, with this account or something like that. Here's another account that can browse the internet but can't receive email or something like that, you know, kind of idea.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, in the blog post, he gives an example of what a phishing email may look like. I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I'm going to give you an example of kind of what he's looking for in here, where the subject line says, I'm a phishing email. And at the top of the body, it says, you know, this is a drill. If I were an actual phishing email, you'd want to do these things. And this is how you can recognize an actual phishing email. You want to take a look at the example. It'll obviously be linked in the show notes. What a phishing drill email may look like.
Yeah, and I like that because that gets back to the training thing we were just talking about. Like, you're telling them what it is you're looking at. You're having them do the thing right there. You're having them physically report it, which is good. I mean, it's just, I just like it. I don't know that that's what I would want to do. Like, if you have to run this 12 months a year, I don't know if it's super helpful to do it 12 months a year, but I think you should at least intersperse these in the middle.
And as he points out towards the end of the blog post, you know, we should be focused on secure by default systems and not relying on the phishing training that individuals receive to prevent compromises. You know, I would agree with that, because what we need better resilience in the face of phishing failure, because there is going to be failure and you can't expect 100% detection. So, you know, we need better prevention, better detection, better response to phishing and not totally rely on end users reporting phishing. And the reason that we're bringing this up is obviously phishing is still a huge deal today. Still one of the primary attack vectors for attackers getting into the network. And what I liked about this idea is that even if you have a phishing training program today, you can still do this type of training interspersed with this to see how it goes. You don't have to throw at your current phishing training program to adopt this concept and see if this is beneficial for your organization or not. You can intersperse a few of these tests in there with your regular phishing training. You know, obviously you want to inform your employees ahead of time that, hey, we're changing the way we're doing phishing emails. We're going to do this kind of concept sometimes, and encourage them to do the reporting, include the reporting in the body of the email, and see how many emails you send out versus how many employees actually report the email. Because obviously what you really want to see is that when you tell them, hey, click this button to report the email, that most of the people who receive the email go ahead and click that button.
Yeah, I think there's a couple interesting things here. I think, first of all, you are, like you said, you're going to have to warn them you're doing something different, because we've now trained employees that if they click on a link in a phishing email that says it's a phishing email, they get punished. And they're going to be like, is this a trick? It's telling me to click the link. Is this like your latest, like...
Oh, man, that just reminded me of an email we got when I was at the Army CERT. Mm-hmm. So the general in charge of INSCOM, the Army Intelligence Security Command, he received an email. And the subject line of the email was, this is the Amish virus. It was a plain text email, no links, no hyperlinks. Like,
print this, it out and walk it over.
The subject line said, this is the Amish malware or something like that. And in the body it said, because we don't believe in technology and computers and everything, it's on the honor system for you to reformat your hard drive and delete everything off of your system. So the general gets his email. So what's he do? He forwards it to his chief of staff. And so what's his chief of staff do? He forwards it to, I can't remember what the position was, but the main IT guy for the organization. And what's this guy do? He forwards it to us at the Army Cert and asks us if this is a threat.
That is one of the saddest things. But, you know, especially in a top-down organization like the Army, where everybody's almost afraid to not do, yeah.
Yeah, to make a common sense judgment about an email that has no attachment, no links in it, and is plain text and is telling you, hey, reformat your hard drive.
So I thought that's actually where your story was going to go, is that like when a general forwarded it to somebody, somebody was like, well, this seems dumb, but the general said to do it.
That would have made the story funnier if, you know, the chief of staff or somebody had actually reformatted the hard drive.
Yeah, we're looking over his history and he's like looking up how to reformat a hard drive. He's like, he spent some time on this. Oh, I almost forgot. So there's two things I want to think about this reporting numbers. Oh, yeah. I think actually what would be super interesting here, you said mix it in with your other, but I want to be a little more specific about that. I would love to see somebody shoot out one of these 1 week ahead of your standard phishing training and then compare the response rate to like be like, you know, oh, you know, 27% more people reported this. And then you can use that as or you can do A/B testing too. Send it out to half your folks and send out the normal way to half your folks and start directly comparing, you know, who's reporting more, who's catching more.
And you can do that to say that you front load that this quarter, but you don't do it next quarter.
Yeah.
And see if the numbers change in your phishing response.
Yeah, that'd be interesting too, to see if it falls off. See if there's a, I think there's a lot of interesting things you can do with this. Yeah. All right. Next article. All right. We have the CrowdStrike outage and market-driven brittleness. You know, we couldn't let this go by without talking about the CrowdStrike thing. This is from
CrowdStrike thing.
The CrowdStrike thing. You know, someone doesn't have CrowdStrike. So Bruce Schneier wrote an op-ed for the New York Times on the recent CrowdStrike outage, but it was bumped apparently to the Biden-Harris brouhaha. So, but it did appear in Lawfare. And the entire essay is about how brittle global internet infrastructure is. And he, of course, talks about how this extends beyond the internet to food and electricity as well. I mean, we can all see what happened during COVID. Supply chains fell apart and it took years to recover in some cases. And he presented a link to the Texas electrical grid. Actually, hold on. I should say before we dive too deep in this, he wrote this with somebody else. It was a combination piece. He doesn't have it at the top, but he mentioned it at the bottom.
No, it's Barath Raghavan.
Yeah, Barath Raghavan. All right, awesome. Just wanted to make sure that we credited him appropriately. All right, so they also present a link to the Texas electrical grid. And I know preppers have talked endlessly about how impossible it would be to replace transformers in the event of a EMP event, because transformers, generally, there's no store of them. You have to build them, et cetera, et cetera.
As needed,
yep. So, and he points out CrowdStrike could have completely avoided this by pushing out 1% as a canary and then going to 10%, et cetera. Or, in my opinion, they could have prevented this by testing it on any single live Windows system. It's not like they need to test it on 100 systems, like one would have figured it out.
Well, maybe a system at their office, maybe? I think they have Windows
machines.
Eat their own dog food. They have machines at CrowdStrike.
Or allowing end users. So right now they have a sensor update policy. You can update the sensor logic. You can choose to be on like N-1, N-2, but you cannot do that for content, which makes some sense. Like if there's something important that just came out, you want to get it out as fast as possible to folks. But it would be nice if you could have like an hour or two. Like we don't want to apply if you'd had like a 1 hour delay, I think it took an hour and a half for them to figure this out and pause it. So an hour wouldn't have done it. But if you could have a 2 hour delay, it would have saved you.
Well, see, the thing is that they could set this out so that the default is no delay.
Right.
But if a company wanted to go in and say, no, I want a delay.
Yeah.
You know, that's on them to adjust their risk posture to say,
we're
willing to accept the risk of reduced coverage for an hour or a day or half a day or whatever, versus the risk of you pushing out a piece of crap detection. Which, you know, bricks our system. For instance, you know, should that happen?
For instance. Or even better, like companies could do the testing themselves. Like they could have, you know, a canary group themselves that gets it initially and then have other groups that get it, you know, 2 hours later, 4 hours later, et cetera.
Yeah. So. Well, that's the way, I've managed McAfee before, because in EPO, you could have different policies like that where, you know, 5% of the enterprise was on the current version and, you know, the other 95% of the enterprise was on you know, two versions back and run like that for a couple of days before you roll them everybody to the current version.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So his choice of who to blame for this is market incentives. He blames market incentives for pushing companies to run as lean as possible, move as quickly as possible, and to worm their way into the infrastructure of all companies as integrally as possible so they can't be replaced easily. And he does mention that there is a penalty, but the penalty is usually small enough or short enough to be ignored. For example, a stock price hit or a small fine that represents a tiny portion of your profit.
You know, one thing he doesn't mention in that list, though, is reputational damage and loss of customers. Because yeah. I'm wondering how many customers right now were in the process of POCing CrowdStrike or were considering moving to CrowdStrike. And now they're like, I think what we got, we'll hold what we got.
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how many folks are going to pull CrowdStrike based on this and replace it. But for folks that are in the POC phase, I definitely see them being like, whoa.
Yeah. Because I can almost guarantee when the LastPass compromise happened, they lost customers for sure with that one.
Yeah. But that was, I feel like that one was easier to pull and to rip and replace. I guess it depends on how extensive your usage of it was.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's not just the current customers, but potential customers also are looking at this and saying, yeah, I'm not willing to take that risk for, you know, to go with that organization. You know, they were not going to adopt LastPass or they're not going to adopt CrowdStrike because of what this just happened with that reputational damage there.
Yeah, there's a couple other things, though. CrowdStrike seems to be, I mean, this is a personal opinion. They're not paying me for it, although they could if they wanted to. CrowdStrike seems to be neck and shoulders above most other providers. If this was something where they were like the third best or the fourth best in the infrastructure, in the ecosystem, I think that would make it a lot easier for people to be like, oh, well, nah, they're not that great anyways. We just needed an excuse to move off them.
Yeah, but are they?
I don't know. It's a good question. If only we had some way of testing and validating stuff against each other. But
But of course, Bruce is going to say this is a market failure. It's not like market there are market incentives for companies to make their products better than other competitors. You know, and he makes a bunch of claims in the article about things which are unprofitable, which is not really accurate. They may be more expensive. They may reduce the profits, but that doesn't necessarily make those actions unprofitable. And the unprofitable things are things which, of course, would improve resilience, as what he said, are unprofitable, which is why companies won't adopt them.
All right. So he makes a house analogy here. He compares the way that we are building software now to an analogy of a house built by dozens of different companies who need continuous access. But if one of them fails, the whole house collapses. So this is how software built. Reminds me of an XKCD, because of course there's an XKCD for everything, which I'm sure you guys have probably seen. It's the one where there's a tower
like
of
a
blocks.
Jenga blocks.
Yeah, it's like Jenga blocks, and it's all modern digital infrastructure. And then at the bottom, where there's a one little block holding things up, is a project some random person in Nebraska has been thanklessly maintaining since 2003, like SSH.
Yeah, I think his analogy is a bit overstated, because he's assuming that, or in the analogy, there are dozens of different companies and every one of them needs continuous access. And if any one of them fails, the house collapses.
Yeah.
I think that's an overstatement that every one of those things is going to cause a total collapse. Sure, there may be one or two or a few, but not every single one is going to lead to collapse if there's a failure.
Only if we're lucky. They finished up the essay by stating that they want to force companies to build resilience into their systems. They bring up Chaos Monkey and Netflix. They point out it requires leadership at companies to commit to long-term profits over short-term profits. And yeah, I mean, that's the case that they made. So I have a couple of discussion points I pulled out here. First is loosely coupled versus tightly coupled. As I was reading about this, this seemed like a tightly coupled system. A loosely coupled system is flexible, allows broad inputs with minimal dependencies, and tends to be very scalable, whereas tightly coupled systems are rigid with strict inputs and outputs and strong interdependencies, where this is what we're talking about with the house analogy. A tightly coupled system is a bunch of stuff that is all very, very rigidly interconnected, and when you jostle something or break something, the whole thing falls down, whereas loosely coupled systems handle it more gracefully. And this is, I actually should have put this definition later. Maybe I'll edit this out and put it down or actually talk about that later. So market incentives, I would personally agree that market incentives don't reward resilience, at least not in the type of resilience that he's arguing. I mean, Dave and I have had lots of discussions about this over the past, but this current focus on short-term profit maximization so you can increase stock price does, I think, tend to lend itself towards who can move the fastest, which is, I find, vexing personally.
Yeah, I wonder if that's got anything to do with stuff we've talked about in the past about executive pay being tied towards the stock price because of tax incentives and things like that versus paying the executives in money. Because then the executives are almost entirely focused on the stock price because that's tied directly to their compensation.
Yeah. I mean, so for looking at stock price, we were looking at this the other day. It was down like 40% or something. Let me go check real quick.
Yeah, I was really surprised that it was that big a drop.
Yeah, so it looks like it's steadied out. So over the last month, it's gone down $131 or 34% over the last month, which is huge. But that being said, the price, the drop started before. It was actually on 4 days straight of decline before this happened on Third Friday, which is interesting. I wonder why.
Hmm.
Like the first $30 of decline were built in before this happened. This happened at 343 and now it's down at 256. That is a difference of $80. That's only about 27%-ish, back of the envelope math.
And I'll check the news to see if there was some kind of announcement or something a couple of days before that. I don't recall anything.
But still, this is a bigger stock price drop than we've seen for a lot of other. Maybe the reputational damage is going to actually work this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, I'm wondering how many people were considering them or just not going to back out of switching or in their conversations with them.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes a lot of sense to me. All right, so his end goal is to convince companies to deliberately break things and make them more resilient and embrace inefficiencies to make them more resilient. By embrace inefficiencies, I think what he means is instead of those tightly coupled systems, like taking the time to build it as a more loosely coupled system, taking time to do more of that testing, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. We're saying that was unprofitable in the article.
Which we've seen companies make that profitable. Like that's like a, we see this a lot in fashion. You know, the fast fashion companies, they throw it out as fast as possible. They don't give a crap about the environment. They just do whatever. And then you've got companies like Patagonia who, at least on the surface, I mean, I guess you make that argument that it's all corporate whitewashing, but people seem to be willing to pay more for a article of clothing that they believe is made humanely and justly and out of recycled stuff. I guess the question is, I don't know if that applies to personal choice because you can, that way you can separate out the commercial groups. I don't know if that applies to companies. I don't think there's companies that are clamoring for, you know, artisan handmade EDR.
Well, it's got a matter of differentiation, right? So I was taking business classes. They're like, you know, if you're going to get into a market, one of the things you need to consider is how are you going to differentiate your product from somebody else's product? And, you know, one of those differentiations in this software context might be that, you know, it's going to be deployed bug-free or we something along those lines, right? It's going to be tested. We're going to test it. You know, so that could be one of the differentiators to say that, you know, we're going to have to do fewer updates, fewer patches or whatever, because our software development cycle is this much better or something along those lines, some other way they're going to differentiate. And it could be along that those lines of what he was saying are unprofitable. Those could be the things that make it profitable because that's how you differentiate that business from one of your competitors.
That'd be interesting. That'd actually make for a more interesting decision point because frequently decisions for these things are made purely by cost or they're made by capability. What you're suggesting is that the companies have the ability to add like our product is a little more expensive, but we are guaranteeing that your systems will not go down.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, imagine, just look at how many, just a simple for instance of how much time does your IT organization spend patching operating systems right now? Right. Imagine that an OS vendor came out and what they said their differentiation was that you are only going to have to patch once a year. You know, and all those man hours you spend patching and vulnerability scanning and all this other stuff, you simply are not going to have to do with our product because that's how much better we are. You know, so I'm not saying that's technically feasible or anything, but I'm saying that could be a differentiator where the excess money that they spent building a solid product may equate to more customers because those customers see the value in purchasing that product because they don't have to spend X number of man hours doing patching and vulnerability assessment on that product now.
Yeah.
You know, they're recouping that cost somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one of the great things about the market is those kinds of things can happen. And I think this article is over catastrophizing the whole thing because he's saying they should deliberately break things. I would say this situation is an example of things being broke, right? Which may lead to better resilience. It's just not taking place at the company or took place after the project was shipped. But breaking things and learning from it is something that we're doing now, right?
Testing. Yeah, we test and prod here.
I mean, sometimes we look at a situation like this and we say, you know, this is a terrible failure and look to blame someone or something when this may be just how it should work. Maybe this is how software development should work. You know, sometimes software is written if there's a certain cost to write it, there's a certain cost to purchase it, there's a certain cost to implement it. And when it fails, there's a certain cost to failure and its recovery, right? Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully we're going to learn lessons from this and there's going to be a reduced likelihood of this happening in the future. But what would it look like if all those certain costs were precluded from happening for this software, for all software? That cost may be too high. And, you know, we should, of course, try to do better, but we can't expect perfection for the expense that it would cost for those things not to have happened or for those things not to be a risk.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he doesn't really mention here is over-consolidation, right? Because Microsoft Windows is 73% of the computer OS market.
Yep.
You know, we can argue why, but it's certainly not because Windows is the best operating system. And quite frankly, I think it's getting worse. Windows is not improving with age.
No, it's not. That's actually kind of an interesting. So thinking about the over-consolidation point you're making, if you remember back in the day when McAfee was working on that like layer that would connect various tools together, exchange layer or something. Yeah.
The threat intelligence exchange, I think.
Yeah. Can you imagine a situation where the signatures are divorced from the software, the detection engine, and you can choose which detection engine product to run? You could be like, all right, so we're going to choose this really robust detection engine that's got a lot of error handling and a ton of testing, and we're going to run that on our, you know, business critical servers. But then on laptops, which are less important, like we're going to deploy this more mass market one that's a little faster and a little more oriented towards that. And then you feed the signatures in separately.
Yeah, so you have signature creation companies.
Yeah, which we're starting to see now. We talked a little bit about Amble Logic and Sock Prime and stuff like that. They're more in the analytics than detection, as we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's one of the main points of like frustration right now is like every EDR company maintains their own detections and they all maintain their own detection teams and they don't all detect the same stuff.
Mm-hmm. This may be one of those things where how AI ends up changing the market, where, you know, AI is doing that generic detection and you are paying for the AI model and then you're subscribing to test sets or something like that that improve the AI's intelligence. And because the AI can consume any kind of test set, then, you know, the AI engine is going to be completely divorced from the test sets you use in order to teach it how to better prevent whatever's going, you know, malware or web traffic or whatever in the environment.
Because that's one of the only ways that I can think of for that differentiation. Because like you were talking about before with the one patch a year and like really heavily tested and really, you know, make sure like that would work really well for certain types of devices, like medical devices and manufacturing devices where they're loath to interrupt, you know, for patching or anything like that. That's exactly what they would want. But then when a company goes out to buy stuff, they don't want to buy, you know, three different EDR products and then try and merge all the signatures together to analyze them in a sim.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they end up just buying one and then, you know, not installing it or creates the monoculture you're talking about. So if something goes wrong with CrowdStrike and all you've got is CrowdStrike, like, boom, everything's down.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, this is a case where the companies are never going to do that because, they again, this goes back to, like, they want to be integral. They don't want to share the environment with two other different AV vendors.
Right. I mean, it's with, yeah, what they call an economics lock-in, right?
Mm-hmm.
They want to lock you into them because the switching cost is too high.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Anyways, back off my random speculation.
Yeah, we move on to your great quote.
Right. So I was reading over in the Schneier blog. I feel like the secretly best part of the Schneier blog is the comments. That's funny because in YouTube, the worst part of YouTube is in the comments. But for Bruce Schneier and some of these security blogs, there's some really good, there was a really interesting quote here from Gerald Weinberg, who is a computer scientist at, I didn't leave the quote up. He was a computer scientist at Weinberg Law University. And he coined this law. If builders built buildings the way programmers write programs, the first woodpecker that came along would destroy civilization, which is, of course, you know, in the theme, a wild overstatement. It would require at least a dozen woodpeckers. But it is.
Unless it was Woody, because Woody could do it all by himself.
Yeah, Woody's an overachiever. No, but like thinking about some of the wild things we've seen in the past couple of years, you know, like SSH under-maintained and companies relying on open source software and big companies making stupid mistakes like this. We didn't even talk about how the mistake happened with CrowdStrike, which, because I'm sure everybody knows, but it's because they didn't actually test their detection signatures. They tested the template and then they would populate the template. And as long as the template, you know, looked correct, they were like, boom, let's go. Although their validator failed too. So just an epic failure. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think the flip side of his law there is, you know, if programmers were held to account for failure, like bad builders are held to account, maybe there would be less of it.
We'd have the housing crisis, but for, it'd be interesting.
But I think there has to be a middle ground there between, you know, the move fast, break things and being sued into oblivion for errors in code, though.
It depends on how critical the system is. Like if it's a video game on your iPhone, like move fast, break it all. Like nobody cares. Nobody likes those
break
games.
Break it twice.
Anyways. But like if you're building EDR, if you're building, you know, deep in the OS at the kernel level stuff, like, yeah.
Right.
Gotta be a little more careful than that.
Yeah, one would think.
But I'd be wrong. So that's why.
Well, the thing is, you know, we're talking about here is that, you know, because of the EULAs and all that, their bad programming is not punished in any way.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, there's got to be some middle ground there, because I think if you over punish it, then we're going to miss out on some great products because people are going to be afraid to build them. But if you don't punish them at all, then you end up with crap.
Yep, we got nothing.
Oh, that's typical for you.
All right. So what you should do about it, the only real comment I have in here is that every company needs to kind of make their own decision on looking at how resilient do you want to make your environment and your products and all of that.
Yeah, well, something else to consider there is, you know, the role that third parties play in your resilience, and verifying that they are performing their due diligence to the level that you're comfortable with. If their failure to perform their due diligence is going to bring down your organization. But that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.